ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Andy Burnham pitched himself as an outsider, not in that sort of populist way of saying I'm against the elites, but I'm from another part of the UK which perfectly well understands the cost of living crisis. Give me a chance to do this nationally.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
It's well known that we don't ask people to contribute based on their wealth.
Older Australians in this instance who might have a lot of wealth tied up in the house they live in, but very low incomes, you're suggesting that needs to change, I think. Is that right?
Well, we're suggesting that work needs to be done in this area. We've allowed the wealthiest amongst us to qualify some pretty substantial amounts of benefits. Now, if we reduce that a bit and reallocate it to the least well-off, we'll still be $20 billion in front a year.
If these sort of savings are so large and these inequities that you're describing are so obvious, why the reluctance to go there? Is it ignorance?
It's not ignorance. It is probably fear.
It's been nearly 12 months since Treasurer Jim Chalmers hosted an economic reform summit here in Parliament House. It was billed as an ideas forge to help us address some of the problems we face with the budget and the economy. Since then, we've had a budget. It forecasts 8 more years of deficits. And just this week, the IMF downgraded Australia's growth forecast. We're now ranked 18th out of 30 countries that it tracks. Meanwhile, Deloitte has also assessed that we're looking at the weakest period of economic growth since the early 1990s. The question is, are there any new ideas to help us address some of these issues? I'm Jacob Greber, here on Ngunnawal Country at Parliament House. Welcome to Insiders on Background. Joining me today is Peter Harris. He's a policymaker, a public servant, and fair to say, an economic reformer with some runs on the board. He was appointed by the Labor government back in the early 20-teens as the Productivity Commissioner. And now the Productivity is, of course, the country's and the government's independent economic think tank. I think that's a fair way to describe it. Peter joins me now from Maroochydore in Queensland. Welcome.
Hey, Jacob, how are you going?
It's great to have you on. It's one of those topics, and having you as the former Productivity Commissioner, I've always got misgivings about using the word productivity in any kind of journalism. I don't put it in headlines. I don't put it up high in lights because it sort of has this effect of turning people off, and it shouldn't.
No, I don't think it should turn people off, but today it's a very overused term as well, if I could say that. It sort of depresses me to see the term productivity put in every government press release, every speech, as if everything is going to contribute to productivity if we can just bend it or twist it in the right way. It isn't the case. The most important things that contribute to productivity are fairly well known. We just don't know how much they contribute to it, but they're primarily things like education and innovation, long-term learning, adaptation, competition, technology improvement, stuff like that. And we need to put a bit more effort into that area. But, of course, I would say that as a former chairman of the Productivity Commission, wouldn't I?
You would. And, of course, I think the thing that sits over the top of it, and I was just alluding to some of these weaker economic forecasts that we're facing, it very quickly comes back to this issue that we don't have enough productivity in this country. And I think we're now, you know, we used to have good productivity in the 90s. It got a little bit weaker in the 2000s and it really stalled in the last 10, 15 years. It's been a while since you've had that job. Has anything changed in that performance? Are there any signs of hope in there at the moment?
Well, I don't want to be terribly pessimistic, but I wouldn't say productivity has recovered to the kinds of levels that we need to sustain ourselves. Long-term income improvement. You know, there's the famous Paul Krugman quote that in the long term, productivity is just about everything. Not quite everything, but just about everything for improving living standards. And historically, we've depended on this, not just us in Australia, but all the world's developed economies have had this singular advantage of something somewhere in the economy that every time you invest another dollar in capital or another dollar in labour, you get $1 or $1.02, you know, a 1-2% improvement from somewhere that you didn't really target at all, but we've continuously had that to the extent that, for example, you know, our budgets in Australia, our federal budgets, have included that as a sort of natural facet of the economy for 30 or 40 years. Very recently, we've downgraded that natural facet of a budget. We've actually worked out that we're not going to get the productivity that we used to get, as you mentioned, in the 90s and early 2000s. We're not going to recover to that without some kind of activity, some kind of effort. But we haven't made that effort at the policymaking level.
Well, we did have that economic reform summit. It was, funnily enough, originally called an economic or productivity summit. They changed the name of it again, I suspect for the reason I said, which is the name tends to deaden people's interest. But it's been 12 months. Do you think we've progressed any of those ideas that we saw come out of that summit?
Oh, I think we have done some useful things. Whether they've come out of that summit or whether they were a sort of a longer-term context of appreciating that productivity has been declining or certainly has not increased in the way we expect it to increase through the last 10 or 15 years, I think that knowledge, that awareness is there. And there was activity, I think, beforehand. I particularly am taken by the idea that the government's tried to revive cooperation with the states from moving regulations that impede the growth of businesses. They haven't committed, in my view, much money to that. Historically, national competition policy, when we first tried it in the 90s, was commitment for equivalent to $5 billion of its incentives for the states in particular to remove the restrictions that they had on a lot of our product markets. Today, we probably need to remove restrictions on more of our services markets. Those restrictions have grown up for probably good reasons in the past, but historically they've remained in place. And I think there's a $900 million budget for incentives to remove those kinds of impediments. And I'm talking about things like, you know, people moving interstate with qualifications but finding they have to re-register or even have to go back to TAFE in some cases.
I mean, it's incredible we still have that problem in this country, that you need to do paperwork to move from one state to another to keep your qualification.
It's extraordinary, and even when you know we share land borders. So, you know, the electrician on one side of the border goes across to practice his art on the other side of the border, has to have a separate licensing arrangement, possibly has to have a separate relevant qualification or a piece of experience or something like that. And as I said, there is work going on in that area. To me, it's too slow, too incremental. But that's not to be critical, because having a go at it is the important thing. I just think we should be doing more of it.
Peter, I want to come round to the budget, because I know that's an area you've been doing some thinking on. But this morning we saw quite an interesting speech from the Parliamentary Budget Officer, Sam Reinhart, pointing out that budgets are often baking in very optimistic forecasts. And I think the unsaid bit of that is that means governments spend money that they don't have, or they assume conditions to be rosier than they are. What did you make of that speech? You may not have read it or seen it, but it's just emerged. But that sense that we get these things wrong repeatedly.
Well, it sounds quite an adventurous thing, and I don't mean that in a critical way either, for the Parliamentary Budget Office to say. Historically, you know, they're a very important and very relevant institution. They help to make sure that when our political parties, when they're in opposition, want to promise something, at least they have the opportunity to find a grounded base. The Parliamentary Budget offers that. It has access to all the models that are used in government to design spending programs and tax reform programs. They're, as I said, a very high level of appreciation for their efforts. And I think it's quite an important thing if the Parliamentary Budget Office has said that.
So these days you're with, I think it's fair to say, one of the country's newest think tanks, the Policy Institute Australia, PIA. And the Institute's just produced a report, which we're actually revealing here on this podcast for the first time. So a bit of a insider's ABC podcast exclusive here. Peter, tell us about this report. It's called Home Truths, The Case for Rebalancing Toward Better Means Testing.
Yeah, well, it goes to the sort of context that I think you've set up in the earlier part of this discussion, Jacob. We've got We're in a situation in Australia where our productivity performance is poor, and yet we rely upon that long term to improve our living standards. That's not about people working harder. It's about having the opportunity to apply tools or techniques or learning or skills, plus having the opportunity to do that in a competitive environment where people are competing for your skills, and in turn those businesses are competing harder and harder for consumers' attention. Now, we've become weaker and slower and tireder in that area, not about the efforts of individuals, but more about the fact that, for example, we're not investing as business heavily in the way we used to invest. The data clearly shows that business investment as a proportion of GDP has been declining for that same period our productivity has been declining. And you can't blame businesses for not investing if the return on that from the productivity growth that they were expecting is no longer there. So we do need some kind of incentive activity for businesses to keep investing. Part of that would be improving our competition environment, without a doubt. But another part of it is likely to be to ensure that the tax incentives that we have for business to invest are clearly not discouraging them. I wouldn't say we have to throw tax benefits at businesses to get them to invest. I just think we have to spend a bit more effort designing our tax system to ensure that we're not disincentivizing that investment. Otherwise, people going to work each day, they're not going to get the better tools to apply those skills that they might have picked up in learning institutions.
Now, the report where you're making the argument really that we do too much in terms of government policy supports, whether it's entitlements, whether it's benefits for families, and as you just said, businesses, that these things are not tested for people's incomes. And that used to be something that was really baked into a lot of welfare in the past, I think you're arguing. What's changed and why is it a problem?
Well, it does link to this question of the budget structure. So if in our budgeting, our spending and our revenue raising in Australia, if we can't rely on productivity to continue to grow at the rate it has grown, we have to have some mechanism by which we continue to pay for these important social welfare supports. And they are important supports, and we shouldn't be talking about abolishing them or otherwise cutting them back. We should be asking, how are we going to continue to pay for them in the longer term? And are they structured effectively to ensure that the benefit goes to those most in need, and that those with greater capacity to pay contribute more to the cost of those services, given that we're in a budgetary situation where we have deficits persisting by the government's own forecasting into the mid-2030s. So we're always going to be behind. We're not going to be able to pay for all these services ourselves. We don't have the ability to tax in such a way that we can breach that gap, cover that deficit gap. So we've got to think in terms of our spending. Is our spending, particularly in this case our social welfare spending, being directed to those most in need? And are we designing to ensure that those who have the capacity to pay for some of these services contribute a bit more? And that's what, from the Policy Institute Australia, we've spent a couple of months with access to all the best quality data sets that are available on this, designing a revised means testing system.
Let's just explain to people what you mean by a means testing system.
Yeah, by means testing, what we mean is if you can contribute more, you should be able to. If you have the means to contribute more, you should be able to contribute more. Yet we've designed, I think, some of our social welfare programs. We've in this case studied four of them, but our age pension, our age care system, our paid parental leave, and our childcare systems, we've designed them pretty much in mind with the objective in mind that everybody can get access to them. They're not universally available, but they're very, very substantially and widely available to everybody who potentially qualifies with need. And in some cases, we ask people to contribute more to their access to these services, aged care an example, but we don't ask them to contribute that much. And we've looked at the skewing, if you like, for how your means to contribute is assessed. And what we find, and it's been well known, quite a lot of institutions have written up about this in the past, it's well known that we don't ask people to contribute based on their wealth. We primarily ask them to contribute based on their income, which is a fair enough thing to do. We're actually pretty weak on income testing as well in some of those programs, but the real glaring area which is in need of reform is that we don't ask people to contribute on the basis of their wealth. Now, as I said, a number of institutions have pointed this out. It's a sort of well-known fact, but I think at Policy Institute Australia, we're the first to go into the area of actually designing a new form of means testing which takes account of wealth, and particularly that wealth that's bound up in the principal place of residence in your home.
So I think one of the interesting things you've found is that if things were targeted a little more accurately or a little bit more in the way that they were in the past, the budget would be something like $21 billion better off.
A year.
Per year. So that's quite a substantial amount when you consider that's pretty much
nothing,
what our deficits
nothing
are.
Trivial about it. And that's for four programs. There are other programs. I mean, the NDIS is the granddaddy of them all, but which we don't touch. And we don't touch because the data set isn't just strong enough for us to make any real design shifts. Design is shifting again as we speak in the case of the NDIS. But across the four programs that we do look at where there's good data available, and that data isn't just how much is spent, it's who qualifies for it and what their asset wealth is and what their income is. So we're able to take that information and design to meet these principles, which are if you have a relatively high level of need and you have relatively few resources, you should get more assistance. And conversely, if you have a lesser need or if you have a higher level of resources, you should get less support. You should contribute more to these programs yourself or not qualify for them at all in the case of some areas where we actually have tests which allow people to qualify for these programs like aged care or pay parental leave where they're earning $350,000 to $500,000 a year and yet they still qualify for these programs.
Now, I would have said that the political class gets nervous about this kind of a conversation because what you're, I think, really talking about is older Australians in this instance who might have a lot of wealth tied up in the house they live in but very low incomes. You're suggesting that needs to change, I think. Is that right?
Well, we're suggesting that work needs to be done in this area. I mean, as you mentioned, the political class, I said to somebody the other day, I'm pretty confident that you'd find a unity ticket, as Bob Hawke, used to call those who are holding hands across the aisle or across the, you know, business and unions holding hands together, a unity ticket between every political party in Australia to say, oh, no, we're not going to touch this sort of thing. Don't doubt that for a moment. But we will need to because our budget outlook, as I said, those deficits stretch out to 2030 or into the 2030s. As the Parliamentary Budget Officer seems to have said from what you were saying a little earlier, Jacob, that's probably optimistic forecasting. There's nothing in the budget structure that suggests how we are going to see that gap, that deficit gap bridged in the future. So we need to start planning now, in my view, to think about how we have better means testing and therefore better targeting of our programs so that they go to those most in need. And as I said, those who can contribute a bit more should contribute a bit more.
So if I've got you right, you're sort of arguing that Australia's become a welfare state in part for wealthy people.
Well, yeah. I mean, every developed country is a welfare state. It's not something that we should be ashamed of or unhappy about. But yes, we've allowed the wealthiest amongst us to qualify some pretty substantial amounts of benefits. Now, if we reduce that a bit and reallocate it to the least well-off, we'll still be $20 billion in front a year. That's the kind of analysis that we've done. And you know, people throw around a billion here, a billion there, as if this is kind of just a made-up back-of-the-envelope number. I want to emphasise, ex-Productivity Commission Chairman, I'm on the board of PIA. I did a lot of mentoring for this piece of work amongst the staff that did it. We have highly professional staff with access to the best data sets. This is a reliable number that could be saved by better targeting how we spend.
So is it a lack of awareness, among politicians, or if these sort of savings are so large and these inequities that you're describing are so obvious, why the reluctance to go there? Is it ignorance or is it a third rail that they're terrified of?
Oh, it's not ignorance. As I said, many public sector and private sector commentary groups and institutions have identified these kinds of problems. No one's done, I think, the design work that we've done. No one's proposed deep breath, you know, how to actually target some of these quite sensitive groups, you know, recipients of the age pension and age care sensitive groups. But we didn't just target old people. I mean, I'm an old person. We went for paid parental leave and for childcare too, because this is nothing about, it's not ageist. It's simply about your income or your income and your wealth and how you qualify. But to answer your point directly, it's not ignorance. It is probably fear. But it's a fear we're going to have to embrace, because we can't see any other way, looking at the structure of the Australian budget, how are we going to bridge that deficit gap in the future? And governments aren't really talking about that. It's almost become accepted that we have deficits at the Commonwealth level whilst we're, you know, still in a reasonable growth phase here. I mean, we're used to deficits arising in budgets when we have a recession or something like that, because, of course, what they call the natural stabilisers, you know, increases in unemployment benefits and other supports kick into play and we run deficits. But right now we're running substantial deficits when we're in a reasonable growth phase. And it's worrying. I mean, I'm not a kind of deficit hawk kind of person. I'm quite used to governments choosing wisely, but still choosing to spend more in circumstances where they think they're investing in our future. But I don't think that's what's happening with our welfare programs. I don't think they're investing in our future.
Well, I guess the argument that I hear, particularly on childcare, is that that is a productivity policy. You know, one of the reasons you do support families to have childcare is so that women can get back into the workforce. Is there a risk there that you do damage by means testing, even well-off families? We want those people back in the workforce, I would have thought.
There is a risk, but we do analyse that. There's quite a bit of detail in the report on just that issue. And it works out like this. We are proposing to reduce the cut-off point from access to childcare from, you know, somewhere around $500,000 a year income across a family to a lesser amount, a substantially lesser amount, a couple of $100,000 a year. In childcare, there's been pretty good studies of this. The incentive for family members who have a child to go back to work is quite substantial if you're a high income earner. That is, you'll go back because you're going to earn a high income. It's low income earners we need to be worried about with childcare, that they don't have a substantial incentive to go back to work. And so we need to make sure they receive support. So we proposed in this, even though we're making a $20 billion a year saving, to increase support for the low income earners, for the bottom 40% of us, and for the higher income earners, and it's really about the top 10% of income earners, to say they either shouldn't get access or they should get a substantially reduced access, because they'll still have, being high income earners, a powerful incentive to go back to work. And the data does show they do. In this country, we've had two serious goes at applying and then increasing substantially childcare support. We've had relatively small improvements, quite small improvements in workforce participation. And that's because the natural incentives are there anyway for people to go back to work. But where we have had some benefit, clear benefits, it's been amongst low-income earners, and we're saying increase support for them. Make sure they have even more support, but effectively redistribute it from those who really don't need it.
One of the real tough parts of this whole debate is usually where you draw the line. And just one more question, really, because it's quite an interesting topic. We could keep going. But where do you draw the line? What is, in your mind, someone on a high income? Where does that start? Where would that level be where, really, you know, you can pay for your own childcare or your own aged care or any of the other services you might have?
We had a lot of debate about this, because my initial thinking when we decided to go into this area was, you know, Australia should have a default line where above that, you're probably not going to qualify for most of these social welfare support arrangements. it's very difficult to pick, as some of my colleagues pointed out, some of my fellow board members pointed out, it's a sort of wet finger in the air guess, you know. My instinct, having worked in this area on and off for 30 years, is it's about $180,000 to $200,000 a year, when most people are saying, gee, above that, you probably can help yourself more than require the taxpayer to help you. But there's good reasons, in the case of the age pension, for example, to give yourself more flexibility, because there's an expectation that people will always be supported in old age. So it is a guess, as my colleagues are pointing out to me, a wet finger in the air thing, and we haven't gone down that path of saying there's a default. But if you're asking me my personal view, I think it's around that area. And the important thing in my head about having a default means testing mentality is that you should ask the question every time you design a welfare support program or redesign one. You should be asking the question, how does this look versus a reasonable expectation for, you know, a means testing bright line? How does this look? You shouldn't have to apply it rigorously and absurdly. You should be able to still make judgments as politicians and bureaucrats leading governments. You should be able to make judgments. But I like the idea that there should be some mentality behind every one of these social welfare programs. It says above a certain income level and above a certain wealth level, you should be able to do more to support yourself.
Peter, I've really appreciated you coming in to describe this report. I think it's an interesting report. People should have a look at it. It's one of those ideas that used to be embedded into the political debate. Certainly when I was starting out in journalism, we always talked about where that line was and why it was sensible to have that line. It's interesting to have that debate come back. I think it's one of those things that people might want to have a think about. Peter, thanks very much for your company.
Thanks, Jacob.
And thanks for your company as well. Be sure to tune in on Sunday. Patricia Karvelas is hosting, and she's speaking to Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy. 9 a.m. on ABC TV and iView. PK will be back in the Politics Now chair on Monday, as will I, and the Insiders on Background team will be back at the end of next week. See you next time.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.